Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers and YouTube. It's the Dark Mark Show. I am Dark Mark, the goth comedian, and my co-host, everybody's favorite horror writer, Nicole Six, will be joining us shortly. But here, I am joined by, and we love talking to Hollywood hyphenates. And I don't know anybody who has more hyphens than this person right here. Model, actress, cheerleader, homecoming queen, businesswoman, now life coach and author, along with she co-wrote a movie. It's going to be a movie, I hope, but a book with, I've got right here, with her grandfather. I got it, but it blurred out. You might as well.
You can't because you have that dorky green screen.
I have that dorky green screen.
So I can do it. I can be the promoter of all good things.
Along with her grandfather, and what a story this is, Mark Arrieta, son of a Basque, and so much more. She's got Debbie's Den, and she's been to the top, the way top. She's been to the bottom, the way bottom. And she's lived to tell the tale and help people. It's Deborah Driggs.
Thank you so much. Yep, I'm here. I made it.
I am so glad. And it's funny
because I'm still breathing. I'm still here.
The best is yet to come. And there's been so much to go. But before we get started, I do have to say that we are being sponsored because I have to match your energy. You always have so much energy. So I'm using this, and you can't see it, but trust me on this one. My camera's doing weird stuff. I don't think we do a lot of night shoots, so it's really weird. But this is Ray's energy drink. This is the best energy drink you're ever going to have. It's Ray's energy drink. This is the Juice Box flavor. They have so many great flavors. Juice Box. They have Baja Lime that tastes like Baja Blast.
See, you should have sent me a case, and I could be sitting here holding it right now. Right.
Well, now you tell me. We've been going back and forth.
Ray's Juice Box. Yum. Ray's Juice Box.
Well, let me tell you something. What's great about this? Zero calories.
Oh, zero carbs. Sure.
Zero crash. I'm serious. I can show you right now, and I just disappeared. I'm so energized. I disappeared. It tastes.
You can't do it because you have a green screen. I'm telling you.
It tastes great.
You got to leave it to the pros.
You are a pro. It tastes great. And if you go to the description in any podcast catcher you're listening to on YouTube, you can get a case of Ray's Energy Drinks for 15% off with our code.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Because you can't get these in stores. They're gyms, they're GNCs, but why pay full price? They're at Vitamin Shops, but why pay full price? Go to our code in the description, and you'll get 15% off Ray's. You've got such an extraordinary story, Deborah. I don't even know where to start. I mean,
I don't either.
Well, it's...
I don't either. That's why I write a weekly blog. You're right. It's like whatever is going on, I get to use this great outlet now to write.
Right.
And that writing has really... put a lot in perspective of you know, a 60-year life, right? I'm going to be 60 years young this year.
And I
feel it in a way, not so much, I don't feel it, I don't feel like I'm getting older, but I feel it in a way like I have had life experience.
Oh, you definitely have.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And so I feel like, oh, I need to write more and really kind of keep track of timelines. And I'll tell you what, I tell people all the time now, when they say, what's your biggest advice that you give to your younger self or to somebody that's starting out in any career?
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest piece of advice is to write everything down.
Right.
Even if you write 2 pages a day, because here's what happens. You get to be in your 50s,
mm-hmm.
and the timelines get lost. And especially for somebody like me who has had a lot of different things and a lot of different life experiences and a lot of travels and ups and downs and ins and outs, you know, and then to kind of go, well, when did that happen? You know? And so I really recommend that you write everything down and keep track of your life. It's worth keeping track of. And when you get to be, like I said, in your 50s and you start thinking about it, like how I think mm-hmm. about it now,
mm-hmm.
You kind of wish that you would have kept better. And I used to keep a lot of journals, but because I moved around a lot, a lot of things kind of disappear throughout the years. But I've always been somebody to keep kind of a day planner and keep notes of, you know, what, whether it was an audition or an appointment or whatever. And so those books I still have, thank goodness, because that kind of helps with the timeline. But yeah, that's my biggest piece of advice is write it all down. It's worth it.
Because I don't do any of that. And I should. I should journal. I should write every day.
Yeah.
But I don't. I write when the whim takes me. And, you know, that's not the way to do it. I see all the pencils in the background. So, yeah, you do a lot of writing. I see.
Yeah. By the way, okay, so somebody thought I was joking the other day because I took a box of pencils and I said, I'm going to sharpen these. And they were like, do you write with a pencil? And I said, are you kidding me? It's all I use. By the way, you see those, right?
Yes.
You're going to laugh right now. You are going to laugh. Do you think I'm a little cuckoo?
No. I've been researching your story for the last month, so I knew.
The first step is admitting.
Yes. You are a pencil addict. That's what you are.
Pencil addict. I have to have them sharpened. And
where do you get the sharpeners?
Oh, I have the one that you don't, the buzz, you know, the one that like happens in 2 seconds. So I can, but I love to write with a pencil. And you'd be surprised, people laugh at me also because I travel with a pencil case. And I'll take a handful of those. And then I can't carry a sharpener with me everywhere I go. But you'd be surprised, I will go through that whole bunch of pencils. They'll be all down by the time I get home. I just enjoy it. I really do. I enjoy, there's something about writing with a pencil. It's almost like it's not permanent. I don't know what it is, but pen, I don't enjoy writing with. And so,
TSA give you crap about it?
No.
Putting a sharp object on a plane?
No. That would shock me.
I don't know. Well, let me start with this because I have, I've been doing copious amounts of research as I usually do. And I have something that's in your high school days, and you went to high school in Orange County.
No, I went to high school in Hawthorne,
in
Los Angeles.
Like, not in Orange County. Okay.
I went to college in Orange County.
Okay. Well, this is, so maybe that's where I'm getting things confused.
Because I'm still confused. So we'll work it out together.
there's a lot going on. There's a lot your story intersects with so many, you know, with Donald Trump, Bob Hope, Devo, all sorts of things. But
Hi, Nicole.
Nicole has joined us. But you said I've heard you say that you were sort of awkward in high school, and yet you were the head cheerleader in the homecoming
there.
Well, I was awkward in high school, and in college, yes, I was the homecoming queen and song leader. But I was very socially awkward, and that's the truth. I was. I wasn't like the popular girl, even though I won homecoming queen. I actually came to Orange County and started a junior college not knowing anybody, because everybody that I went to high school with went to El Camino.
Right.
Or somewhere else. And so I didn't know anybody. And so I got to kind of start over, which was nice because my high school was a little tough for me. You know, I went to a private Catholic school to eighth grade, and then I got turned loose to it was different from a private Catholic school than going to Luzinger on Rosecrans and Prairie. And at that time, that neighborhood wasn't so safe. And I got street smart real quick.
You were such a competitive figure skater when you were a child. You had that discipline even back then. You were getting up at 4 a.m. do figure skating when you were, 10 years old?
Oh, yeah. I started really young. I started skating, I think I was in, right when I was starting first grade, this is how I started. I got invited to a birthday party at an ice skating rink in Harbor City. Mm-hmm. We were living in Torrance at the time. And they couldn't get me off the ice. Like, I loved it. And, you know, in those horrible rental skates where everybody's feet, you know, flop. And I loved it. I ran around the skating rink and I just thought, this is like, I loved this way it smelled. I loved everything about the ice skating rink. And I came home and told my mom, I want to ice skate. And so she put me in group lessons and I flew through it and got to, you have to go through all these different group lessons. And at the end, then you decide whether or not you want to take private lessons. And I was like begging, you know, please. So I started private lessons. And then about a year later, it started getting like serious. Like I was skating in early morning before school. We were trying that out. And then when it was getting more and more serious, then I switched ice skating rinks from Harbor City to Paramount, mm-hmm. which back then was a big deal because now we're driving 45 minutes before and after school. Mm. And so I had to get up earlier. And so I was really, you have to be committed.
very dedicated to it.
Yeah. To get up that early as a kid, and you have to really want it, you know, and I did. I loved it. I loved the people there. I loved my coaches. Mm-hmm. I loved that life. It was like, it was my home away from home.
So what happened? How did you get out of it then? Because you know, was it just that you weren't going to make it on an Olympic level, or you just fell out of the passion?
No, I, you know, here's the deal. My home life wasn't stable. Mm-hmm. And there was talk of my parents getting a divorce. And I know that my mom was working really hard so that I could skate. Mm-hmm. And because it's an expensive sport. And right. I think right before high school, it just became apparent that it just wasn't going to work out to skate and then get divorced. Like it was all too many things happening at once. And so I ended up quitting. Which, you know, looking back, I kind of really regret because I could have just maybe skated once or twice a week just to keep it mm-hmm. up, but I just quit. And I think that was the moment when it just gave me an idea for a blog. Sorry, I got to write it down. I got to write this down.
Get that pencil. Get that pencil. Nicole, do you see the pencils in the background?
This is real time.
That's a lot of
pencils. I had to write that down because because this is really true, is that was probably that first moment, that first impulsive, like black and white, like either it's I'm going to do it all or I'm not going to do it. Like the mm-hmm. rebellion in me came out for the first time.
Right.
And it was like, you know, the efforts, you know, effort, mm-hmm. you know.
What was
you, by the way, we encourage profanity, so you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
But
I can get the point across without it.
I understand. I'm just saying there's no restrictions here.
Yeah.
What was your most memorable experience skating? Hello?
I'm thinking.
I'm sorry. No, it wasn't you. It was my phone.
One of our guests should think.
God forbid I take a moment here. let's see. You know, there's so many, but I would say, you know, like, milestones, like the first time I landed an axel without falling, you know, my first competition was horrendous. You know, I fell on every move and came off the ice hysterically crying and was yanked into the bathroom by my coach telling me that was not allowed, this behavior, that this poor me victim was never going to be allowed. And that was such a great life lesson, mm-hmm. you know, because it was like, that's the way it should be, right? Like, okay, you get back up.
Right.
And that's, she's like, what are you crying about? You fell, you get back up, we go back to work. And so I was like, you know, I thought my whole life was over because I really, it was a big mess. And so I remember that. But then I also remember going to Seattle and competing in Seattle and landing every jump and having a great routine. And so that was great. And then things like watching Diane DeLue on Saturday morning prepare for the Olympics, because she mm-hmm. nobody remembers Diane DeLue. I bet you don't remember, but she won the silver medal behind Dorothy Hamill.
Okay.
Nobody ever remembers the silver
medal. But people remember Dorothy Hamill.
But we remember Dorothy Hamill. But Diane DeLue
Just think what an elite skater, the person that you're talking about, who was name I already forgot.
That's what I'm saying. So my coach was Diane DeLue's coach. And so mm-hmm. I got to watch her skate and prepare for the Olympics. I watched Ty Babiloni and Randy Gardner skate mm-hmm. every Saturday morning. I liked going to Anaheim and skating with Barbara Rolls, who was a famous coach back then. You know, mm-hmm. there's just like these little moments in time that happen. And this is the coolest thing. So in 2017, I went to Burbank and I had a coach and I was skating. And Randy Gardner showed up to, he was coaching one morning when I was there skating. Right. And I said to him, I used to watch you and Ty skate on Saturday mornings at Paramount. He's like, oh my God, with Doug Chapman and Kathy Steele and like all the coaches and Frank Carroll. And we were like reminiscing, even though they're older than me.
Right.
We were reminiscing because I was a kid watching them, you know? So it was kind of cool.
They were kids then too. I mean, they were, you know,
they were kids, but I was really young, you know? I mean, it's funny when you look, when you're 10 and they're teenagers, that's a big age difference at that time. Now we're the same age.
Right. And you guys are, you're skating at 60 and 70.
Yeah.
Or 55 and 65 or what have you.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Now, well, not only were you around elite level athletes then, when you got out of, when you were 19, you became a cheerleader for the USFL, which if people don't know, I guess they're trying to bring it back. But in the 80s, they had a football team to not compete with the NFL, but that had football on when the NFL was not having football in the spring. And it was a big deal. And you became a cheerleader for the LA Express. And you were doing routines choreographed by Paula Abdul at the Coliseum when you're 19.
Yeah. It was the United States Football League. And that was the whole thing is.
It was Steve Young was the quarterback who was one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time.
Yeah. And it was to have football year round. And it worked the first year. It got, I mean, the whole thing was selling tickets. Are people going to want to watch football all year round? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it lasted more than 3 years. And so I don't know how it's going to work if they try to bring it back. But back then they made a push for it and Lee Majors got on board. He was one of the owners of LA Express because he was at the last audition that we went through several auditions to make the squad.
And you were the youngest, one of the youngest people
to audition. I was one of the youngest. It was me and the girl that I went to college with. We were song leaders and we decided to drive to the Hollywood Palladium together to audition together. And we both made it. Both of us 19 and both of us wearing braces and we look like two little kids on the squad compared to these very voluptuous cheerleader type professional cheerleader. Cause all these girls that were like two of them were on the Rams already and a couple were from the Raiders. And so, you know, they were like, great, we can cheer all year round, but then it became a conflict that they didn't want the NFL cheerleaders cheering for the USFL. And it became like, we were all new or they had to leave the NFL. And some of them took a risk and left and came and cheered with us. But yeah, so I was around these girls that had been doing this and they were very like back then, the cheerleaders were voluptuous, big hair, 80s hair, if you remember.
Yeah. This is early 80s.
Farrah Fawcett hair. And
and you're hanging out with the $6 million man and Steve Young.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, what a time. And
it was.
Did you make any friends?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those moments that, you know, it's like I went from cheering in college to now I'm in LA doing morning shows, going on press tours, going to the mall to perform. And I just thought that was the greatest thing on the planet. Like I thought performing at the mall in front of 100 people was like the greatest thing ever. And if I could have done that for the rest of my life, you know, like that's what I was thinking at 19. Like, oh my God, could I just do this every day?
Little did you know that now there's no malls.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no malls.
Mall culture has died, which is sad to me. Renegade CBD.
I'm so excited about it. We were teasing it for so long, and you couldn't get anything done with it.
And you got samples.
I did get samples. Yeah. By the way, that was actually Charlie. I had just turned my phone off so that I wouldn't get interrupted, and he was like talking about how it's going to be really exciting around here with the new CBD line. So
yes. Well, I saw the website, and not only is the CBD great, and Nicole can attest to it.
It's delicious, too.
Well, because they have gummies and they have white chocolate, lest people think you're eating the plants. They have gummies and white chocolate and other things.
And the gummies, they use an actual confectionist. Charlie was very proud of this. This person genuinely makes candy for a living.
Right.
So that's why they taste so darn good.
Right.
But you got to be careful with that because you can eat too many.
That's true. Don't eat too much. But I sound like somebody's mother. But also, Renegade CBD if you've gone on their website, very affordable.
Yes.
A lot more affordable than the CBD I get around here.
It's so easy to use. I looked at it today and I'm like, man, this website's really structured and convenient.
And it's Charlie Renegade. I was surprised myself. Anyway, renegadecbd.com for all your CBD needs.
How did you go from that to modeling in Japan?
So one of the girls that I was cheering with on the squad, she and I got invited to go to Japan to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And in Osaka, they had this famous street in Osaka called Shinsaibashi. Back then was like Vegas. It was all mm-hmm. lit up and it was right. just this whole beautiful world. And there was a lot of clubs and dancing was huge in Osaka, but it was more like, it was very interesting because the Japanese like to dance in front of a mirror. So they dance to themselves in a mirror, you know, and
that's very goth, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, it was like so wild. And the girls were wearing poodle skirts. It was like, really like I was in a time warp. And they had my girlfriend and I, and there were two guys that went with us and we were on boxes. Like we were like Soul Train dancers. Right. And we went back and forth. The clubs were back to back and there was an alley in between. And one was called the Bamboo House and one mm-hmm. was called Jubilation. And we did three shows at each. And we just had a blast. We slept all day and we danced all night. And while one of the nights, the promoter that brought me over asked me if I wanted to do some catalog work while I was in Japan. And I said, okay. And basically they had me on a stage dancing around in a poodle skirt. Like from the 50s and 60s, it was crazy. Right. And so they had me doing all this catalog work. And so now I'm getting tear sheets and I didn't know anything about modeling. And when I came back to the US 6 months later, first of all, I didn't want to leave Japan. I just thought Japan was the coolest place ever. I love the food. I love the people. I just thought it was great. And they are so generous. They were so generous with us. Like every job I did, it was like, I just thought I had won the lotto. You know, mm-hmm. I'd never seen that much money
right.
at 19.
Yeah.
And so I was sending money home. And I remember my mom and her husband at the time picked me up from the airport. And I said, I'm going to model. I'm going to be an actress. I'm going to feel like, I was so excited. And they were like, okay, let's just get through lunch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I'm moving to LA. This is what I want to do. I know this is what I want to do. And, you know,
you already got your taste of superstardom.
Yeah. And they knew nothing about acting, modeling. Like they didn't know, what do you say to somebody that tells you, I want to be an astronaut? You know, mm-hmm. somebody said that to me, I'd go, great, you can do it. You know, that's how but most people would be like, yeah, you know how many people make it as an astronaut? Like it's a real like small number of people that make it. And that was the response. It was like, Deborah, you know how many people want to be an actress or want to be? And I didn't care. It was right. like the more people pushed against me, I was like, watch me, just watch. And so, yeah, I had money. So I booked my first workshop, which was a place called Tepper Gallegos.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I found this place. I mean, to be honest, I don't know how I did all
there was no internet back then.
There was no internet. And I did this all myself. I found them and mm-hmm. I called and I said, I want to start today. And they were like, we have a class starting on Saturday. And I said, I'll be there. And I drove back and forth from Orange County to Hollywood to do this commercial workshop. And at the end of 6 or 7 weeks, they brought in agents from all over LA. And they had us improvise a commercial. They gave each of us a script as if we were at a commercial audition, like they do when you mm-hmm. walk in and you have to sell a car or soda or a beer or whatever,
right.
or toothpaste or shampoo, whatever it is. And so we each got something completely different. And then we had to get up in front of all these agents and do the commercial as if we were at an audition. And three agents that night wanted to sign me. And so I thought that was a good sign.
Yeah.
I was on the right path because obviously I was doing something right.
Right.
And so here I am now 22 and I got signed with an agency called Pacific Artists and they sent me on my first commercial. They brought me in, explained to me how everything worked, that they would call me and tell me the audition. And it was my responsibility to figure out the address and figure out how to get there and always get there an hour before because of traffic or getting lost or whatever. But
this is before Google Maps, kids.
Oh, I had a Thomas Guide. Are you kidding me?
No, I remember Thomas Guide. I'm old school.
You know how many times I had to pull over and look up in the Thomas Guide, you know, like, oh my God, I'm lost. And
P12. Like, yeah, I remember.
I'd be crying, you know, I'm going to be late. And so I got the call, and it was my first audition, and it was for a Japanese commercial.
Ironically enough.
And it was for a non-dairy coffee creamer called Creep Christie. And I go to the audition and I booked it on the spot. Like, they booked me on the spot. They said, you're booked. It was a week's work of, 7 days shoot at $600 a day. And I thought, oh my God, I'm a movie star. I just was to the moon and back, you know. I just thought, I booked a commercial. And that was it. Then I was off to the races.
You booked a lot of commercials. I sent Nicole the Mazda commercial that you were in that I remember when I was a kid. I remember that distinctly. I didn't even know that was from a takeoff of the movie Giant, because I've never seen the movie Giant. But you play like an Elizabeth Taylor type, like James Dean's mumbling. You're like, shut up, we're trying to sell trucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a famous one.
We're trying to sell trucks.
Exactly. Oh, that's, yeah. Thanks. Thanks for doing that, because you did it a lot better than I did. And you also did a movie with Mickey Rourke in Japan.
I did. No, we shot. Okay, here's the story for that. That was for another Japanese, for Suntory Whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl, and I'm spacing on her name right now, but she's the beautiful French actress who's in the movie Breathless with Richard Gere.
Right.
And she and Mickey Rourke are doing this commercial, and she had to fly home to France. And she couldn't finish the last day of shooting, and they went crazy to cast her. Basically, I came in to fill in for her to finish the commercial. And so I had no idea what it was for. All I knew was, this is an emergency audition, and they really want to see you. And I think they actually paid me a lot of money, because they needed to finish this commercial, and she had to leave to go back to France. And I booked it, that another one that I booked on the spot. I had no idea what it was for. It was all top secret. I got to the Universal lot. I think they shot the next day. And I said, what is this commercial? And they said, it's a Suntory whiskey. And I said, oh, for Japan. Oh, cool. Okay. So I go in my trailer, and somebody came in and said, we're going to take you over now to meet Mr. Rourke. And I said, Mr. Who? And they're like, Mr. Rourke, Mickey Rourke. You're going to be working with Mickey Rourke today. And I went, Mickey Rourke, as in 9.5 weeks, Mickey Rourke? And they're like, yeah. And I literally went, hold on. And back then I had a car phone. I had a Chevy Blazer and I had a car phone.
Wow.
And I had to go call my roommates. I'm like, oh my fucking God. You're not going to believe who I'm working with. And now he was the first big actor that I ever worked with.
What was he cool? Was he all right?
So yeah, nice. He was married at the time to a Deborah Fury.
Right.
And he couldn't have been nicer. I was so starstruck. I couldn't even look at him. I was just like, oh my God.
This is like 80s. This is like 80s Mickey Rourke.
Yeah. Like, now if I run into him, I'm like, oh, I did a commercial with you in the 80s, you know, like, it's no big deal. But back then I was like, whoa, I can't even talk.
He was a huge star then. And
he was huge.
You know, biggest sex symbol in the world.
Yeah.
And yeah. Speaking of sex symbols, now unfortunately, my blurring is not working out, but I wore my Playboy tie. And the reason I wore my Playboy tie, obviously, is that Playboy, yeah, it's not going to happen. But trust me on this, I'm wearing a Playboy tie. And you...
Okay, well, if you turn off your green screen, we can see it. But
right, but...
I told you, it doesn't work with a green screen.
I know. It's you kind of see it right here? You kind of see it?
Oh, I can. Okay, yeah, okay. I can see
All right. So all right. I disappeared again. So
kudos points.
Now, you auditioned for Playboy, and this is early 90s. So this is, we're talking a few years later. You've been modeling, you've been doing commercials.
1989, I got the call.
Now, this was to do a lingerie shoot. And
it was to be on the cover of the lingerie book. I don't have it here in front of me. I usually have some, but
well, trust me, I got a friend that's got every issue, so I can, if I need to cross reference.
It was to be on the cover of this new, they called a flat that was coming out, and it was to be on the cover. And they called my agency and said, we'd like to audition her for this new book and we want her for the cover. And so when they called me about the audition, I said, well, is there any nudity involved? Because that's how I related with Playboy, is that there's nudity. She said, I don't think so, Deb. It's just for the cover. And they didn't mention anything about any nudity or anything. And so I said, okay, well, where's the audition? It was at the famous Playboy building on Sunset. I showed up and they handed me a robe and told me to take everything off and I was going to do Polaroids. And I said, oh, no, 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 no. I'm not here for that. I'm here for the cover of the lingerie book. And they said, well, everything we do, we're going to see your body. Now, in 1989, here's the deal. They were looking for tattoos, mm-hmm. birthmarks, scars.
Nobody had tattoos then.
Piercings. Nobody, you didn't get hired if you had all that.
Mm-hmm.
Today is a different world. Mm-hmm. Today we welcome all that.
Right.
But back then it was kind of a hassle and they didn't want to have to airbrush and do extra makeup to cover all that. And so that's what they were really looking for is, you know, to see your body, to see your skin, to see if you had any big birthmarks that were going to be a problem. And so that's just the way the world was in 1989. And so I said, well, I'll leave my undergarments on. You'll see my body. And so I did the Polaroids and I left and I thought, well, that didn't go very well because I wasn't really the nicest about this. And mm-hmm. I didn't really like the fact that I had to take off my clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just treated it like a swimsuit audition and I left.
Sure.
Well, I got a call that afternoon from Marilyn Krabowski, who's the chief editor of Playboy. And she talks like this.
And I How are you, Deborah?
Back then, you pressed a button when you got home. For those listening that don't know what I'm talking about, it's an answering machine. And you press a button and you retrieve your messages. And so I went home and I checked my messages. And she said, we want to test you to be a centerfold. And I thought, what? She's got the wrong girl. So I called my agent and they said, no, it's true. They've already called us and they want to send the contract over and they want to start testing you. And I was like, well. Wait a second. Yeah, it changed my whole life.
It really did.
Yeah, it really did.
You became a cover girl and you were on the cover.
I did three or four covers for Playboy and
right.
I was on the cover of the lingerie book. And
well, you were on the famous cover with Donald Trump.
That's Brandy Brandt. Everyone thinks that's
not you. I thought you said
Brandy will let me take credit because she doesn't like Donald. So
right.
He's always tell everybody it's you.
So wait a second, it's not you on the cover because I thought you said, you're in the centerfold or
centerfold of that issue.
Oh, so okay, but you're not on the cover.
My issue is now a collector's item because Brandy, who is married to Nikki Six, was on the cover, and then the following month I'm on the cover of the magazine, April 1990.
See, I gotta check out my friend who has every Playboy issue and kind of cross-reference those things.
Yeah, but that's okay because everybody thinks it's me and she and I look a lot alike.
Through Playboy, I mean, you got so many things. You actually were on one of the last Bob Hope specials.
Yeah, I did. I flew to Acapulco in 1990 and did that special with Kirk Cameron before he turned very religious. And that was probably...
And he had to be like in his 80s, right?
Kirk Cameron?
No, Bob Hope.
Bob Hope. Yeah.
Well, no, I tell you, we got Kirk Cameron here in Evergreen.
No,
I tell you, boy.
Yeah, no, Bob was definitely in his 80s. No, he was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was amazing. Phyllis Diller and who's the other one that he always, and Jillian, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could just, that's a weird lineup.
And I'm so bummed that I can't find it anywhere. I used to have all this stuff on tape, but I'm so bummed that I don't have this because it's so funny because we did a whole skit on Donald Trump because it was right when Donald was going through his divorce and he was cheating with Marla Maples and he was cheating.
Oh, okay.
It was coming out that he had all these girlfriends. And so we did a whole skit about Donald Trump. Bob Hope played Donald Trump and Angela.
Bob Hope put on the wig and played Donald Trump.
And I came in as the chambermaid, like, you know, like, hi, I'm here for you, Donald. And it was a whole skit and it was so funny. And I can't find it anywhere.
Well, I tell you, I'm real rich and I cheat on my wife. That sounds like a great sketch. That's a horrible Bob Hope impression, by the way.
It's, I was going to say, I don't know who you're trying to imitate, but.
It's sort of the standard Bob Hope thing. Is, start off, and then they do that. That's kind of the standard Bob Hope happy impression.
Playboy hired me immediately to be the first VJ for
Hot Rocks, which was the video's too hot for MTV.
Yeah. And that, I'll tell you what, that job paid for my 2-year acting class.
That's great. But what was weird is that Jenny McCarthy sort of took that over.
She did. Because I booked a film with Michael Nuri, the star of Flashdance.
Right.
And they had brought me in for 2 or 3, maybe even 4 auditions. And the producers finally took a chance and hired me for this part to play this model drug smuggler character. I don't really, you know, it's so many years ago now. But yeah. And so Michael Nuri was the star of the film. And so I thought, Playboy's Hot Rocks, or, you know, should I really pursue acting and should I get serious? And then I started booking pilots.
Right.
Which none got picked up. But, you know.
Now, when Jenny McCarthy became such a big star off of that, did you have any regrets? Did you have any?
No, because she left. That could have been me. No, because she got hired on MTV, which is what blew her up.
Right. But, and then around this time, you're in the Devo video, Postmodern Man, which is one of the weirdest videos I've ever seen in my life, even for Devo. This was them trying to make a comeback. And boy, this is not the best song or video for a comeback. It's not their best. And I'm guessing the way the video was shot, you probably never met them. I sent Nicole this video. You're in the bedroom in your underwear waiting for Devo.
I'm the come. Girl. Well, Donut was his girlfriend. There's a whole storyline. It's it's the singers. I'm his girlfriend. It's he made it known that his girlfriend was Donut.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Not in that video, but he had a storyline about Donut in another video. Oh,
okay. Because, if you see that video out of context, you're like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
No, if you're a Devo fan, then you know who Donut is.
This is not the best song they've ever done. You shouldn't have you watching one of their good 80s videos in the video. You're watching the Girl You Want video, and it's like, wait a second. I want to watch that video. I don't want to watch this video. So it didn't result in a deep. You did not bring back Devo.
No, unfortunately.
Despite your best efforts.
Who knew?
And you were in a few erotic thrillers, a couple of which I have seen and haven't seen in a long time. But those, you know, when I was that age where I would go to the video store and get these,
Night Rhythms. You're talking about Night Rhythms.
I'm talking about Night Rhythms. Yes, I've seen Night Rhythms. Hewitt. Yeah, but Night Rhythms is definitely, that's all just... Yeah.
No, that's just
softcore sex.
So yeah.
And I remember that distinctly. But around this time, you got married to a very prominent man, another Olympic athlete, Mitch Gaylord.
Yeah.
A great looking guy, and a guy that it's weird because male gymnasts from when he was there became big, and I don't think a male gymnast has been that big a superstar since.
No.
Well, I don't know why. Females are always the talk of Olympics.
Yeah.
But male gymnasts aren't.
I think he became so famous because going into the Olympics, he was the number one gymnast in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that had never happened. I don't think a U.S. gymnast had ever been going into the Olympics like everybody was eyes on him.
Right.
And he had 2 tricks named after him, and then he wasn't hard to look at, so you know he became in the 80s with all those Teen Beat magazine, he was on the cover of all those magazines and constantly, and so and I think also he immediately went into commercials, and when we met he had just done American Anthem.
Yeah, they gave him a movie. Yeah.
With Albert Magnoli, who just came off Purple Rain. So you have to imagine Albert Magnoli is slated to do this movie, American Anthem, and it's supposed to be huge.
He made Prince a movie star. Now he can make Mitch Gaylord a movie star.
Yeah. And so it, when it didn't do well and it got pulled from the theaters, then that was a big upset because it didn't just forget Mitch, but I mean, Albert Magnoli, it kind of messed up his career. But yeah, so then I met Mitch in acting class, in the 2-year acting class that
I didn't know that. Okay.
So we met in acting class.
Because you guys started working about the same time as far as
getting. And what's interesting about it is during the first year, we really didn't speak that much to each other, like, you know, hi and casual and all that. But we got paired up at the end of first year to work together.
And the two best looking people in class, I would assume.
Yeah. We had a lot of competition and a lot of good looking people in our class. Mm-hmm.
And what drew you to him originally? Like, what was it that made you attracted to him?
Well, besides his really good looks, no, he has a very sweet soul. And you feel that from him immediately when you're in his presence. He's just a very sweet, kind. He's not a boisterous person. He's very humble and kind of introverted, really. He's not a huge extrovert. So it was interesting, you know, to be in class with him as this Olympic athlete and then to see him acting and see a different side of him. He's just got a very sweet demeanor and he's kind. And, you know, I was drawn to his creative soul. He has a very creative soul.
And also this takes you back to when you were a competitive figure skater and being around those people.
Well, yeah. And, you know, not to mention there's a little synchronicity there with me growing up as a figure skater and understanding that competitive, that there was a draw there because I understood that competitive spirit. It's a bummer too, because I was in Japan during the 84 Olympics. So I never I wasn't here when the 84 Olympics were here.
Right. But it's weird because they tried to make him a movie star and they tried to make the other gymnast champion, Bart Conner, a movie star. They gave him like a kung fu movie and that bombed. And no male gymnasts have been superstars ever since. Simone Biles and females, they're always the talk of the games. But male gymnasts who, I mean, that's just as tough, if not tougher.
Yeah.
They don't get it. But and then you had three beautiful children with him.
Yep.
And like I say, you can't beat those genetics. You and he are like supernaturally beautiful people. So I would imagine your kids are just unbelievable.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
I would imagine.
I think they're very sweet, sweet, kind humans. If I were to describe
them. Well, that's more important.
It is. And that's how I would describe them. They're very kind. I
think it's nice that she thinks her kids are good people and that's more important than looks.
Right.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And they are good people. They're like, I'm so proud of them. They're just, it's so cool to, you know, you hope for good people, right? You don't know what can happen. And I just think that they really care. I'm around a lot of different aged kids. And now my kids are in their late 20s. It's interesting to see how just developed and beautiful they are as far as, like, they don't hang out on their phone and, you know, they're really present, you know, and
well, that's because you gave them a Thomas guide. That's why.
That's exactly right. I made them memorize that thing. I said, if I had to learn it, so do you, even though you're never going to use it, you know.
And one of those car phones that's attached to the car.
They've always had navigation. Right. They would not know what to do. God, can you imagine? We have a whole generation of kids that just would not know what to do.
Oh, there's a whole generation of kids that don't know how to do a lot of things. But
it's crazy.
Our story is going to take a bit of a dark turn for a few minutes, but we're going to get back up because you had an alcohol problem during the marriage. And was this because the spotlight wasn't shining on you anymore?
I don't think that would be a reason. You know,
because from the outside in, you think you have the idyllic lifestyle.
I don't know that addiction falls that way. I don't know that. And it really progressed when I got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
So because I just remember being like 40, divorced, not a lot of money, not a lot of options, and thinking, this sucks. So I'll just have a glass of wine, you know, and I just, you know, women go down harder and faster with alcohol and it progresses. And so I think it was managed.
I don't know if I could divide on gender lines. I've seen a lot of guys go hard and fast on alcohol.
No, they do too. They do too. But women, it's statistic that women go down really hard, really fast. But I would say that in my 30s, it was there, but I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I just always thought maybe I was postpartum depression or, you know, that I didn't understand why everybody could move so easily through life. And I always felt like something was off. And I didn't really know that it was an addictive thing. I just thought I was having a bad day a lot. And so it was in my 40s that I started to realize that I did have an addiction and I did have something that needed to be looked at.
And from the outside in, I'm sure a lot of people saw you and him and your beautiful people, beautiful children, and think that's an idyllic life.
Of course. I mean, I remember when I started to be more open about things that were going on. And I remember people's response was like, you always look like you have it so together. And that was kind of true. I put on a really good, or I tried to, you know, there were certain people that could see through, but, you know, I just plowed through stuff that really needed to be looked at and dealt with. And I never took the time to work on myself. We didn't do that back then. Right. It's a big thing today to work on yourself, to work on self-love, to like, everybody's talking about it today, but in the 90s or even the early 2000s, nobody was talking about self-care and self-love and detoxing you know, all these different boundaries and relationships. I mean, there's so much available today. I think it's amazing because we have so much abundance around us that we can tap into anything quickly, whether it's a podcast, a book, a radio show, an interview, anything. Everything is accessible today, which is so beautiful. So I think, you know, just taking some time and learning about alcoholism and learning about that it's not just about binge drinking. It's there's other things to addiction that surface, you know, even if you're not picking up a drink, you could be suffering. So I kind of like to know all that now, where in the past I had no clue. I didn't know that it was a thing, you know, who knew?
But you learned the real hard way and behind the locked doors in the rehab.
Yeah.
After a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I had a major breakdown and ended up on a, what do you call them, 5150 or whatever, where they just kind of watch you and kind of like, is she going to flip out on us? What is she going to do? And I remember thinking when I was in there, when I was in lockdown, which I'm not a place you ever think you're going to end up in a psychiatric ward. And I remember thinking, Deb, pull it together. Or this is going to get worse. Like, get it, like, pull your shit together now, because it's scary in there. Like, you're locked. They take everything from you. There's no phone, and you're in a mental ward and you can't get out. And so I thought, oh, stop being obnoxious and start pulling it together. And there's just a little bit, you know, of sense in me at that time, because I was really down. And I just remember sitting in front of a board and them deciding my fate. And I was in Utah at the time, which is a lot different than California. And so I chose to go to rehab, is because it was presented to me in a way where it was like, you can go to rehab or we can have the courts decide what to do. And I thought, no, I don't want the courts to be involved. So I'll go to rehab. And so that's how I ended up in rehab. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I learned about a disease I knew nothing about.
Right. But it's an amazing story. Actually, this podcast, quite frankly, was born out of a nervous breakdown, although it wasn't quite as extreme as yours. Honestly, I had a nervous breakdown about 10 years ago. And and I was presented the, because my comedy career was just stalling. And I really was literally just in a horrible way. And then somebody presented me with the opportunity to do a podcast, you know, back when there was nobody doing podcasts, and I had a new creative outlet. But I'm glad. I mean, you had a like real fight or flight sort of scenario, and you fought and you won.
Yeah, I think too, what happens is when you start to when you don't have an understanding of something, it can get worse because the fear sets in and you know there's something really wrong, but you don't know what it is. But when you start to have an understanding of something, it becomes less the scariness, it gets lessened. And that's what I needed. I needed somebody to go, you're okay. You're okay. You just have to do this, this, and this for the rest of your life and you'll be okay. And
And can I ask you a question? Do you think the fact that you were going through a divorce coming from a broken home, you think that exacerbated it?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Because, you know,
that's the last thing you wanted to do.
Well, and I have to say there are certain things that have happened in my life where that familiar, like devastation, abandonment sets in, and my divorce triggered it for sure. Cause I was completely like out of my mind. Like I was just crying all the time. And I think besides the alcohol, I think that my first codependency was with the ice skating, you know, cause when I lost that, I felt that complete devastation and like that codependency sickness. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I had experienced it this harshly until I was going through my divorce. And I was like, whoa, I know this feeling, back up, you know? And so I got to kind of go through it again. And it hit hard. It really did. It hit hard. And, you know, you don't know what you don't know. But now when I look back, I can see it in a very different way. And it's very clear to me what was really going on is this codependent divorce. And yeah, the crazy thing about the whole story is that I don't think Mitch wanted the divorce. I asked for the divorce.
Really?
And then I completely regretted it. So it was like, you know, be careful what you do, be careful what you wish for. So this is why I'm so inspired. And
this is why
I do what I do today. This is why I work with women. I have a woman right now that I'm working with who is living in a hotel because she thinks she wants to get a divorce after 32 years of marriage. I said, no, 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 no. Let's work on you first. And then after 90 days, if you still feel this way, then I'll help you guide you through it. But I don't think that's what you want. I think you're just in a funk. And I wish somebody like me existed when I was, you know, in 2003.
That was Deborah Driggs, yeah.
I was excited about this sponsor. I had to jump on this when I saw it. And I'm looking forward to getting samples of this. Tactical Soap.
I saw that it has pheromones.
Yes. Now, is there anything more attractive to you than a great smelling guy?
I think it's important to smell good.
You have to smell good.
Yeah.
And if you smell good and you have pheromones.
Well, that can only help.
That can only help. Get Tactical Soap. They have soaps. They have lotions. They have colognes infused with pheromones. So it will drive the women crazy. And if you go to the link at our site on the podcast sites or on YouTube, it'll take you right to where you can get your own Tactical Soap. Once again, very affordable. I'm looking forward to trying it myself.
Let me know how it goes.
That was about 3 or 4 Deborah Driggs ago because you were in Utah and you became a very successful real estate agent.
Yep.
Then the 2008 crash happens. And then you reinvented yourself. And this is, I don't know if you knew that we had this in common, but we're both insurance agents.
I did not know that.
Yes, I was a property and casualty agent for years, homeowners. Okay. And now when the pandemic hit, I got my life license.
But
I'm not near what you were because you became one of the top selling life insurance agents in the world. And I mean, in the country.
In the country, yeah.
In the country. You were on the $1 million board, which I'm familiar with.
Yep, $1 million round table.
Well, you're on $1 million round table, yeah, which I'm familiar with, but I misspoke what it was, but I'm familiar
with it. Yeah. because you have to sell a certain amount of premiums to even be invited. Mm-hmm. And it's a real small group. And I remember when I went to the first meeting, gosh, it's that island in Georgia. I don't know why I'm spacing on the name of it, but they brought us to this beautiful island in Georgia. And that was in 12 or 13. And I had really done well those 2 years. So I was part of that for about 3 years. And then I decided, because I had had, that was the first time I had had some real good, steady financial success, that I wanted to travel the world.
Right.
And I wanted to take my kids traveling.
And that's great.
I wanted them to travel the world. So we spent like 5 years, all of us traveling, sometimes together, but my son traveled the world. My daughter lived in Israel for a year. We all traveled, and I thought that was I made that a priority because my son was having a hard time in college. And I remember saying, take a gap year and go travel the world, find a community so he found this gap year program where they did all this community work, and he went everywhere for a year, and it changed his life.
That's all thanks.
Yeah.
What do you contribute your success in sales to? What is it about your personality that makes it so easy for you to do so well?
I really care about people.
Or is it easy?
It's not easy at first. You know, anything that you're trying to sell at first, you have to marry it, right? You have to kind of fall in love with it. And I actually like life insurance, and I like what it stands for. I like preparing people for unexpected life events. You know, you find something sexy about what you're selling and you make it your own. So I think that in sales, anybody who's in sales kind of figures this out or they don't. And that's why a lot of people drop out pretty early on, because they can't figure out how to marry the product or the service that they're trying to sell. Mm-hmm. And until you can find that sexy way to sell it, then it goes bust for you. You get frustrated.
Right.
You're not making commissions. And life insurance, as you know, is a commission-based business. So you have to sell.
Right. I thought I was the sexiest insurance agent out there, but I guess you are. But let me ask you a question, and this is just an insurance-based question. Well, this is actually a life-based question, honestly, and I'm working on this. This is last year I worked on my weight, and I lost 40 pounds and other things. Now I'm really working on, since the beginning of the year, and we talked about this yesterday, me and Nicole. I'm not a closer in any aspect of my life. Never have been. I'm somebody that has no problem opening or going up to stranger and talking to them. I have no problem having an engaging conversation, as I hope you've found out tonight. But for some reason, in business, with women, with show business, I just have problems closing. Something happens.
Right away. So if I was coaching you, do you know what I would say to you right now?
Right. Pay for a coaching session.
I would say, is that really true?
Yes.
How do you know?
Past experience. A lot of past experience.
All of it?
Not all of it, but most of it.
Can you think of a time when you did close something?
Sure.
The thing that's
interesting, for every time I do that, I can give you 20 examples where I didn't.
I know you can, because that's what we're trained to do and what our brain likes to do, is show us all the times that we didn't do something and forget and negate all the things that we did do. Mm-hmm. And what I train people to do is to, first of all, the minute you say, I'm not a closer, guess what? you're not
a closer.
Right. But you're great. Well,
I'm striving to be a closer.
You're
Let's put it
great
that way.
At opening. You're very confident with opening, right? You said, I'm great at opening. I wonder how that would shift for you if from now on, for the next 90 days, all you said every day is, I'm a great closer. I'm a great effing closer. And if you got in the mirror every day and said that, I think something might shift. You'd be shocked. Because our language and the way we talk to ourselves and the things that we say to other people are exactly true. They're exactly what we say we become. So that's why I always say, is that really true? How do you know? And then obviously you're going to show me all the evidence. why it's true.
Because Nicole told me I wasn't. So, no, I'm kidding. I don't want to throw Nicole over. No, but
I wouldn't listen to that at all.
I said, don't spend too long there. You have a tendency to, I don't remember how I said it, but basically when he gets to a certain point, sabotages it.
That's very common.
Yeah.
So let me tell you why people sabotage. It's called resistance. There's a great book. So it's not something that I'm making up. There's a great book called The War of Art. And I have that. Okay, well, you need to read it.
I've read it. I need to read it again.
Read it again. And I'm going to tell you why. The whole book is about what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's about the resistance to anything, whether it's a relationship, whether it's to writing, whether it's to doing a comedy act, whether it's to doing a one-man show, whatever it is we want to do in life, we have some sort of resistance that's going to pop up. It's just natural. It's just going to happen. And so it's how do we navigate that self-sabotage? It's going to pop in, that little thing that's going to give me all the reasons why I should not write a book. They're there every day in my ear, telling me all the reasons why you should not write a blog, you should not write a book, you should not go on this podcast tonight because you're too tired. You should not, you know what I mean? Like we're always resisting. And the trick is to flip it around all the time. And it's work. And it's work to do it. And that's why most people just sit with, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm da 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 da, whatever. Because it's work to actually sit and keep shifting it all the time. Like I have to catch myself all the time. Every time I hear myself say something that I know is not true, I have to go, well, that's cancel that, erase universe. That is not what I meant to say. And I switch it. Mm-hmm. So it's work to kind of always kind of be on top of it and thinking in terms of what I say, I become.
Right.
And what I say about you, I become. Mm-hmm. Think about that.
All right. From
right? The, I mean, think about
from
it.
From Deborah's lips to,
how many times have you said things about like, oh, that guy was kind of an asshole? Be real careful about those too. Because what we say about you, we become also.
Well, if that guy's an asshole.
Well, our subconscious doesn't know the difference, by the way.
Okay.
Language is everything.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, oh, she was a drama queen or she was this or she was that, we're just attracting more of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm very careful to not even notice that stuff anymore because I don't want to attract that into my life. And I used to do that all the time. You know, I used to, you know, let myself go in that direction. Now I have to stop and go, no, not going
there. I usually acknowledge something, then put up a boundary. Like if there's something that if I see someone that's drama, I don't waste my time like getting mad about it. They're just being themselves. I just put up a boundary that'll keep me away.
And you don't even have to label it. Don't even put it in the universe. Don't even
think about it.
No. It's like the best words to use sometimes are just that's curious or that's fascinating or that's unusual. That's too bad. But when we start using like real adjectives and things, the bummer with it is we get it back. Mm-hmm. We get it.
Mm-hmm. That's
we get it because the universe can't differentiate. Yeah, the law of attraction. It's exactly right, and it works.
It's it's funny because I was going to ask you what separates your life coaching program, because that's the new chapter in your life, one of the new chapters in your life, from everybody else, because there's so many coaches out there.
There's
Mike Tyson's,
so many.
Mike Tyson's doing a life coaching program now.
Yeah, there's.
I saw
so
that
many.
On my Facebook page.
It's unbelievable.
So what this separates you from everybody else?
I have
else?
To tell you something. This is the funniest thing. Okay, so there's an app called Clubhouse. Are you familiar with it?
Yes.
Okay. So in October, I have this brilliant idea to go on Clubhouse, and you know, have a club where I have people come in and we talk about stuff. every single club on Clubhouse is life coaching. And I thought, wow, this is really something, you know? So yeah, there's a lot. Like I go in Evan Carmichael's room a lot because I think he's so brilliant. And he has all the time, like Louise Hay and Ed Milote and Tony Robbins and all these great speakers and motivational people. I think what sets me apart is that I'm really, my jam is relationship stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you fail a lot at something, you want to get good at it. So you pour you immerse yourself in it. And I really immersed myself. I went through the NLP training and I've gone through the Tony Robbins training. And then I started writing a weekly blog, and they were all in the beginning really geared towards relationships. And then I got asked to speak on a panel at this relationship summit. And I thought, okay, the universe is guiding me right now, you know, because at first I thought I was going to be a sales coach, really, where I was going to help mm-hmm. people really
close,
talk close. And what I found when I started to work with some people in that field is that we had to clean up and organize a lot of the personal stuff that was preventing them from putting their best foot forward. And then I thought, gosh, I should just take everybody through a 90-day detox, because that's what I did. You know, whenever I get to a place where I get stuck, I just kind of detox out my life a little bit and get organized again. Spoke at this relationship summit, and that changed the game for me, because when I spoke and talked about what I did, how I took 90 days, because I had realized in 2019 that I had never really been alone since high school. I've mm-hmm. always been or with a boyfriend or in a relationship or engaged. I was engaged 3 times before I got married, and then jumped out of a divorce into another 4-year relationship. And then, you know, I've never been alone. And I was like, I'm gonna do a 90-day program. Well, first I'll tell you what I was going to do. I was going to do this 75 hard when that started, the whole craze of the 75
hard. Excuse me, what is 75 hard?
It was a program that was a big craze. Everybody was doing 75 hard. It was a big workout program.
Oh, okay.
And so
I thought it had something to do with night rhythms. I didn't know.
No. And so, no, bad joke.
I'm full of them. Go ahead.
Okay. So no. So I said, why am I doing other people's programs? Let's do your program. And so when I spoke at this relationship summit, I was the last speaker of 20 speakers. It was all virtual. And Alison Armstrong was a speaker. John Gray was a speaker. These are all like expert relationship experts. And I was the mm-hmm. last speaker, and each speaker gave something away. Well, being that I knew that nobody knew who I was in the life coaching world, I thought, well, I'll just give away my program. Nobody's going to sign up for it because nobody knows me. So at the end, after I spoke, I gave away my 90-day program. I got like 40 emails like immediately of people wanting to sign up. And I went, whoa, you know, like the universe doing for me again. And so that's kind of what made the decision to really go down that road and work with people regarding relationships. And so some of those people are still working with me today.
And that's 90 days of...
Yeah, I take people on a 90-day journey. So here's how I look at it, because I've been on both sides of this. Mm-hmm. Usually people hire a life coach and they think, okay, give me the answers, and then they want to move on. And here's the thing with coaching. It's an ongoing process. It's like, it doesn't end. Like, I still have mentors and coaches in my life. So it's not something where you start and then there's a finish. It's an ongoing process. There's things that come up. There's things that change. So my commitment with people is we do 90 days or we don't do anything, because they're not going to get results. And anything in life you want to change, any habit, any behavior, it's 90 days. Some people will say 30. I say to really break a habit or to change the way you're thinking about something, it's 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I started the whole life coaching.
And you have, and obviously, I mean, you've already demonstrated how good you are at it. I think you might be better than Mike Tyson. I just have a hunch.
I'd work with
Mike. But don't tell Mike that. I don't want to get my ass
kicked. I would book a coaching session with him just to see what he's got going on, because he's fabulous.
He's fabulous. And if somebody has eclectic life than you, it's Mike Tyson. That might be the only person alive. And speaking of eclectic, I mean, this podcast has went by so fast, and I thank you for taking the extra time. And that's when you know it's good, right, Nicole?
Oh, yeah.
And thank you for taking the extra time. But I would be remiss without saying that you're going into Nicole's world now, and you've written a book. And this is just an amazing story, just the backstory of the book, in that you found a manuscript in your grandmother's garage of a manuscript that your grandfather wrote and tried to get published in the 80s, I believe. 90s?
So it's, he wrote it over 40 years ago. He passed away in 1998. I actually gave the eulogy at his funeral. Mm-hmm. And now after publishing this book, it's like, oh boy, did I not do that? You know, if I would have known what I know now, I mean, this man had a phenomenal life. And then when my grandmother was really ill, she got very ill in 2016-17, I flew to Lakeland, Florida to be with her when she was, crossing over.
Right.
And we were cleaning out her garage, and I found this box with all this, I still have it, all this loose typed paper that was kind of yellow now. And it was just a big mess. And I just opened it, looked at it, and I asked, could I have this? So I shipped it to LA, and it sat here for 2 years before I actually opened it and looked at to see what it was. And if you can imagine, I have a dining room that I moved everything aside, and I just kind of tried to piece this thing together. And when I kind of made some semblance, some sense of it, I sent it to somebody who's a writer, and I said, what do you think? Give me your honest opinion. Would you go down the road of trying to get this published? And also I knew there was a lot of holes and a lot of rewriting, but for the most part, I have to say it is really, I've kept it pretty authentic to what he wrote. And so she said, no, it's cool. I flew through it. And I said, I don't really want to add to it, or what do I do? It's his book, And so I worked on it for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it was not easy because it went back and forth. And then, when you try to fact check stuff, I wanted to make it his autobiography. I couldn't. What,
was
it
intended as his autobiography?
I don't know. That's the whole thing. I really don't know, because there wasn't enough information except the manuscript. There wasn't enough information. And so at first in my mind, I thought, well, this is really about his life. But then it just became, it's really hard when the author's no longer with you to, to make all these decisions and then rewrites and everything. And so I decided it was going to be a novel and a historical fiction. And it's not up for debate, because if you make it a true story, then it's up for debate. Like you got to fact check everything. And we couldn't do it because there's not enough people alive. Nobody in his family is left. And so I didn't have anywhere to go with it. So we just made it a historical fiction. It's based on his life.
Mm-hmm. I think it was an extraordinary life.
I think it couldn't have gone better. It's a beautiful story, and I'm super proud of it. And I'm getting ready to do the Audible version.
Oh, wow. That'd be great.
I'm not going to personally do it. It's going to be in a male voice.
It's an extraordinary story, because he was in World War II as a tail gunner, if I'm getting that right.
Yeah.
And it's a love story about him and your grandmother.
Yeah,
and
they were married over 50 years.
And just so many things that you didn't know about your family and how extraordinary
they
were.
Well, the things that I didn't know were boom, the first chapter. I was okay. it just starts out with, his dad dies and he's 10.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He becomes the man of the house at 10. And then the other big jolt was...
And he never talked about that.
No. No, well, I didn't know anything about his family until I read the book. And then even then, it's not a lot about his family. It's more about his immediate and then a little bit about his dad, a little bit, but not mm-hmm. a lot. You know, he had a lot of brothers and sisters and mm-hmm. not a lot there. And so, but when his sister fell in the well and died, I was like, God, yeah. What is going on? The first chapter is just like, boom. And then, you know, I could visualize it like that being the opening scene of the movie, this little girl walking out and looking in the well and falling in, like, and then that's the opening scene of the movie. And I thought, I think I want to make it into a screenplay,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's so many hits like that throughout the book that I was like, God, you know, when you're reading a book, it's fun to imagine it as a movie. And I remember when I read Silence of the Lambs
mm-hmm.
and the movie wasn't out yet. You know, the book was a number one bestseller. And I remember reading that book and I was imagining that book as a film. And then when the film came out, I thought, not very often do I say that, but that movie was just as good as the book.
Right. But slightly different.
Yeah. But that's kind of what's fun about reading when you mm-hmm. read a book, is to kind of imagine what it would be like as a live film.
Right. You know? Once again, kids, there's a thing called books, and we read those, and we hold them in our hands. And what's great about this book, and
they smell good.
Oh yeah,
the way they smell.
Let me smell your book.
They smell good.
It smells good. It's Son of a Basque, and if you sign up for your weekly blog for Debbie's Den, you're in the continental United States, you get a book.
Especially if you're listening to this show, if you subscribe to my blog, subscribe to my personal letter, I will send you a signed copy of my book.
And say you heard it on the Dark Mark Show.
Yeah, and mention that.
Please do. Because I see that this is a thing. I buried the lead. I should have waited for you to say, oh, it's a Dark Mark exclusive, but it's not.
It's not, unfortunately. I really am generous. This is about what I have left, and then I have a big stack over here. I've given away almost 500 books,
right?
Which I never thought I would, but you know, every time I speak on Clubhouse, I offer it, and people subscribe, and so it's been really beautiful.
Now it's time to sell it.
Yeah, I think once I do the screenplay, that's gonna put it over.
And it'll be a bestseller, no doubt. And do you see yourself doing more writing?
Oh yeah, I wrote a chapter in a book called Here Comes the Sun, and I have mm-hmm. a book coming out this year called Now What.
Right.
No, I have the bug for sure. I love it. I'll tell you the part that's the hardest is right before I sit down to write, because I will think of 1,000 things I have to do before I sit down to write, that resistance thing that I'm talking about. But the minute I sit down and start writing, I'm like, I love it.
Has that been your experience, Nicole?
I leave my house to write, so I don't think like that. If I have it at home, I'm not going to do it. But if I leave and I specifically go out to a place just to write, I will write.
Yeah, which is beautiful. My daughter does that. She goes to the beach. She takes her journal and goes to certain places that it's like, those are her writing spots. Yeah, I get that too. Yeah, I have a whole little thing that I do before I write. So I really put myself in a state, you know, ask for guidance, and I do a little meditation, and I have a whole routine. I get my tea, and then I put on my music, which is very, very light. And, you know, it's like a whole thing. I put a bandana on the door so nobody bothers me.
Oh, wow.
They'll just barge in, you know, but I go, hey guys, here's the deal. If there's a bandana, that means I'm writing. I'm in a process.
Yes. Deborah's in a trance. She's writing and you cannot disturb her.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you have entranced us. You have an extraordinary story, and we barely scratched the surface, obviously. But
I don't want to
keep you all night.
I just need to do a documentary and call it a day.
Well, you need to write your autobiography. Hey, I'll do your documentary. I would love to do your documentary. It'll be something. You need to write an autobiography, which I think you're probably working on, if I've heard correctly on another podcast. Which it, you know, there's so much more. I didn't even get into like. you were big in the 80s, and just all I could just only imagine the hijinks in the Hollywood scene that you got into then. But as I said, and how you look eternally beautiful, and you're just about to turn 60. Unbelievable.
Thank you.
Unbelievable. Thank you.
Yeah.
But
it is.
It's the Basque in you.
Okay.
It's the Basque in you.
That's where my anger comes from. That bastion. Woo. I have a joke that I say that aging gracefully is a full-time job, but it is a lot of work to really age gracefully. And like, you know, it's all an inside job, man. I just like, I avoid, you know, as much as I can, but you know, every once in a while I'm like, okay, I'll take a little Botox, but then I kind of regret it every time. Like, I'm like, why'd I do that?
Right.
You know, because there's something about just really aging gracefully. And there's something about that youth. You keep your youthful look when you're not pulling yourself back all the time.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah. Trust me. I've dated
it's kind of
enough
cool
older
to
women.
This,
I know.
All these wrinkles and thing, you know, because if I pull it all back, I just look fake, and it's not good. And I think the big thing that I won't do is let my hair go gray. I'm like, no, I like my burgundy hair. I'm going to keep it.
Hey, why not?
Yeah. There's certain people that are like, just let it go gray now, you know, be natural. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not ready to be gray.
I'm struggling with that myself, but, Nicole, I see that Trouble has joined us.
Yeah, he was clawing at my lap, so I let him join me.
Trouble the cat is in Nicole's lap, which means probably we should. I could talk to you all night. We could talk to you till 1 in the morning, but you got stuff to do. I think your plugs are going to take quite a long time because you got so much going on. So please tell everybody everything you got going on.
Oh, it's
everything
super
you want to promote.
Easy. It's super easy. So here's the deal: to be in contact with me, or you know, to kind of keep in the know of what I'm doing, I have an events page. So I let people know when I'm guesting on podcasts, and I do write a weekly blog, and I send out a blog maybe once a week or once every other week. I don't bombard you with a lot of stuff. If you do want to book a complimentary session, if you're struggling and you want to, I have a couple spots on Saturday left. But that's it. And, you know, I all my links to social media, everything is at my website. So that's why I like to have a website, because it has everything.
And that's DeborahDriggs.com.
Yeah. So easy. Easy peasy.
Yes. And you can join Debbie's Den and get the blogs. And if you say you heard it on the Dark Mark Show, and only if you say you heard it in the Dark Mark Show,
yes,
you get a free signed book.
Signed copy of my book.
The exception being Nicole. I'll
okay,
make sure
now here's what
Nicole
I'll throw in for your show.
Okay.
Because I have not done this, so I'll do it for your show. If you mention to me that you heard me, I'll not only send you Son of a Basque, but I'll throw in Here Comes the Sun.
Two sons for free. S-O-N and S-U-N. Just for us.
So that's just for you. So now you have an exclusive.
We have an exclusive. Thank you so much, Deborah.
Thank you, guys.
That's the way to close. And by the way, speaking of books, Nicole, tell everybody how they can get your book.
You can find me as Nicole H6 on Facebook or Nicole H6 Books on Instagram. And then the link to my latest poetry book is in my bio.
Beautiful.
And I'm Goth Comedian on all social media. Go to gothcomedian.com, and everybody, have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.